What do dictators, CEOs, and political leaders have in common? We thought it was prime time to re-explore some of their strategies for getting and keeping power with Alistair Smith, co-author of The Dictator's Handbook, Why Bad Behavior is Almost Always Good Politics. And first, what does the U.S. midterm election result mean for international relations, ethical consideration of U.S. border policy, and the future of U.S.-Russia relations? Guest host Doug Becker speaks with three experts. Doug is professor of international relations at USC, and here's that discussion.
You're listening to the Scholar Circle. I'm Doug Becker, and we're looking at what the U.S. midterm election results mean to international issues, ranging from issues of environmental protection to the question of violence on the border to broadly the U.S. relationship with institutions like the United Nations. Joining us for this segment are Pam Chasick, who's the chair of the Political Science Department at Manhattan College. She's the author of Transforming Multilateral Diplomacy, The Inside Story of the Sustainable Development Goals, as well as Global Environmental Politics and the Global Environment in the 21st Century, Prospects for International Cooperation. Amy Eckert, who is professor of political science at the Metropolitan State University of Denver. She's the author of Outsourcing War, The Just War Tradition in the Age of Military Privatization, and a book chapter entitled Critical Approaches to the Ethics of War. And Brent Sasley, associate professor of political science at the University of Texas at Arlington. He's the co-author of Politics in Israel, Governing a Complex Society, and author of an article, Palestinian Roadblocks, Changing Attitudes Among Israeli Jews. So let me start in general, just to get your thoughts about the impact that any sort of international issues may have from the midterms, with a quick reminder, as we all know, and to remind the listeners, that foreign policy really is the purvey of the executive branch. So ultimately, how much control and how much influence Congress can have constitutionally as well as practically is somewhat limited. But I do think there are some distinct implications. So, Pam, let's start with you. What do you think are some of the most important takeaways from the election?
For the environment?
A policy in general.
For foreign policy in general. Sadly, not much. I think that while Democrats did take the House, that many people will see the fact that the Republicans maintain control over the Senate, which tends to have a stronger role in U.S. foreign policy than the House does anyway, because the Senate is responsible for the ratification of treaties. And so with Donald Trump still in the White House and the Senate still controlled by Republicans, there may be a bit of an oversight check on the part of the House, but I don't think it's going to make a big difference. I'll be interested to hear what the others think.
Amy, what do you think?
I would tend to agree with Pam in the sense that we're unlikely to see significant changes in the executive branch. And, you know, obviously we've been seeing a lot of foreign policy issues and problems coming out of the executive branch, the diplomacy, the reversals where we're kind of pushing away traditional allies and embracing, you know, authoritarian regimes around the world. And, you know, even in terms of what's happening at the State Department, we've got a State Department that is woefully understaffed. We've got 40 vacant ambassador positions still 2 years into the Trump regime, you know, including countries like Turkey, Saudi Arabia, our major allies, Mexico, Australia, have no ambassadors to represent the U.S. in those countries. In addition, we have a huge number of civil service positions that are also empty. Even at the assistant secretary level, we've got about a third of the assistant secretary positions that are still vacant 2 years into the Trump administration. So, you know, part of this is kind of a shift in emphasis away from diplomacy to an emphasis on the Department of Defense, a more militarized foreign policy. But, you know, if we're looking at what could change or really the role that the House could assume if it chooses, you know, Democratic control of the House means that we're going to have Democrats chairing committees like foreign affairs, like intelligence. And what this means is that they can utilize the congressional power to investigate, and they can compel testimony, they can compel production of documents through subpoenas, and, you know, perhaps bring some accountability to a body that, you know, up until the midterm elections had by and large been kind of a rubber stamp for the administration in terms of its foreign policy. Long shot, we could see some legislation, but that's going to require, you know, some defection in the Senate on the part of Republicans, which probably not all that likely.
Yes, I echo that concern. And the House can't force the president to actually nominate ambassadors, so that's always obviously.
Yeah, unfortunately, they can't. So, I mean, it's unlikely that we're going to see those positions being fully staffed. And, you know, I mean, there are just some obstacles in the executive branch that kind of stand in the way in terms of, you know, Trump not wanting to appoint, you know, certainly Democrats and also even Republicans who've been critical of his foreign policy. So he's got kind of this list, if you will, and just kind of generally the shift away from diplomacy toward a more militarized foreign policy.
Brent, your thoughts?
I agree with Pam and Amy. The system isn't set up for the House to have all that much of a say in foreign policy, although I would add that there are two potential areas or spheres which the shift to a Democratic House might have an effect, and one is kind of intangible, and that one is I think that foreign leaders, or certainly at least American allies, are looking at, they might take hope from the election, to put it that way. I think that they're very, certainly after 2 years, they've become not just uncertain about the Trump administration and therefore American foreign policy, but unhappy. And they're looking for something that they might be able to latch onto that gives them a sense that things might go back to the way they were, or that there is some check on the Trump administration in the government or in the American system, and then that might make them, it might have an influence, or it might shape some of the ways that they approach some of the foreign policy issues that they've been dealing with, including getting around the United States. And then the second area is what Amy mentioned. I think if the Democratic-controlled committees do begin a series of investigations, which so far they seem to indicate they will, that could well distract the Trump administration from doing a whole bunch of other things related to foreign policy, and therefore their attention wouldn't be on a whole range of issues from climate change to North Korea to the Middle East. And then that, it's unclear if that would be good or bad, but that could well be an effect.
Hey, you mentioned climate change, so this is a great opening for Pam. I know a great deal of the first 2 years of the Trump administration has been rolling back, not obviously walking away from the Paris Accords was a symbolic move, but where so much of the action has taken place has been an executive action, reversing a number of executive actions by the Obama administration, some of which tied to Paris, but you know, really ranging across numerous issue areas. Are there any issue areas, Pam, that you can see maybe where some of this reversal might be reversed, and that we might return back to some of the previous protections?
You know, it's possible that we'll start to see some movement in the House. According to the League of Conservation Voters, 46 new quote-unquote pro-environment representatives were elected to the House, is what they're claiming, that we're going to have a new chairwoman of the House Science Committee, who actually believes in science, Eddie Bernice Johnson. This is the House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology. We will also have other chairs of committees in the House who tend to be more pro-environment and more concerned about climate change. But the problem is we're not going to see that on the Senate side, and we're certainly not going to see that on the White House side. And if these elections showed us anything, that a number of environmental initiatives did not pass in these elections, state initiatives, and largely because oil, gas, and coal companies, fossil fuel companies, basically poured millions and millions of dollars into these states to defeat the initiatives. And my sense is that money is still going to be pouring into the coffers of those who want to, you know, those who would vote against any clean energy conservation or climate change legislation that might emerge from the House, but will probably be dead on arrival in the Senate and would definitely not make it through to the White House unless there's some trade-off that I just don't see happening right now.
Maybe the most important thing that a Democratic House provides is a forum by which Democrats can present a platform that they intend to run in 2020. And so could we see legislation making its way through the House, likely dying in the Senate, but kind of symbolic legislation?
Probably. But it's not, you know, it may be symbolic, but it's really not going to help us achieve, you know, global climate change or global warming of less than 2 degrees centigrade. symbolism, unfortunately, will not be effective. Most of the action that we're likely to see is going to be on the state level, which is where we've seen most of the action. But I try very hard to be optimistic, but I don't see the states being able to do as much as that is necessary without support and legislation at the federal level. So we've got a number of new governors who are elected who may be likely to incur, and new state houses that are now controlled by Democrats. But we have to remember that being a Democrat does not make you an automatic environmentalist and does not make you automatically concerned about climate change. And we tend to conflate that at times.
Yeah, Joe Manchin certainly comes to mind in the coal industry
exactly.
in West Virginia. Now, Amy, I know you do quite a bit of work on ethics and the use of force. I'm going to turn to you and ask, you know, some of the most newsworthy developments over the first 2 years of the Trump administration took place right there on the border. And with so much of the emphasis being on immigration, on the caravan, and raising some ethical issues about the use of the military along the border, do you think there's going to be any sort of change in that profile? I know a lot of it has to do with politics of, you know, declaring that, for instance, the military will, you know, they'll shoot at anybody who's throwing a rock. But what sort of implications for the ethics of the use of force, for instance, along the border, does the success that the Democrats have had, if any?
Oh, that's a great question. In theory, this is an area that's subject to congressional control, right? The Constitution gives Congress the authority to declare war, not the executive branch. However, what we've seen, you know, for a number of decades is the executive branch kind of assuming kind of ever-growing authority over the use of force. And certainly, I think this administration obviously is not an exception. And here, you know, in this particular instance where we're sending troops to the border to deal with this caravan of immigrants, you know, we're not actually sending them out of the country, right? They're patrolling the border. And, you know, the reality is that, you know, Customs and Border Patrol, you know, the military kind of have extensive jurisdiction within the territory of the U.S. That said, specifically, you know, the issue of, for instance, shooting rock throwers is kind of, you know, it's obviously very troublesome from an ethical perspective. The idea that we would be shooting someone who's armed only with a rock is fairly horrifying. And, you know, what kind of encourages me on that point is we've seen pushback, actually sometimes quite publicly, from members of the military on this particular issue, stating that they're not, you know, going to shoot unarmed civilians or people who are throwing rocks, which is heartening, and, you know, very much consistent with the obligation that members of the military have to disobey orders that would be unlawful, and certainly firing on unarmed civilians would fall into that category.
Yeah, and what's always so disheartening to me isn't just what American policy, you know, would necessarily be. I mean, obviously, border issues and the impact on the people at the border, asylum seekers at the border, is pretty disheartening. But some of the stories coming out of more authoritarian regimes citing the lack of U.S. interest in enforcing these sorts of norms as well, giving a kind of carte blanche permission for regimes like, for instance, the story in Nigeria of the military citing firing on unarmed civilians throwing rocks and saying, well, obviously what we've done is justifiable based on statements made by the president. You're listening to The Scholar Circle, and I am Doug Becker. And we're looking at what the U.S. midterm election results mean to U.S. foreign policy, ethical considerations of U.S. border policy, and the future of U.S.-Russian relations. Brent, I know a great deal of your research is on emotions in politics, and certainly these last 2 years, we've seen a number of pretty intensely emotional displays ranging from, you know, some of the historical memory on issues like Confederate statues to the symbolism, and I would argue probably more of an emotional symbolism than anything else, of moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem. Does this election address those issues at all, and where do you see the next 2 years going on some of these more emotional reactions in American politics?
Well, I'm not an Americanist, so I want to be careful what I say about voting patterns, but it seems to me that there's a greater awareness of the value of, there always has been, any political campaign, you know, recognizes the value of appealing to one's emotions or a group's emotions and their fears and things that make them happy or sad. But it's pretty clear, so there's some debate about whether or not Trump's stumping for candidates and references to the xenophobia and the caravan and referencing all these things that plays really well to his base, based on fear of others or fear of social change brought on by including others, whether that was some kind of strategic calculation or whether that's just who he is, and that's just what he talks about, and he thinks that's appeals to both him and to the people close to him. But either way, it seems to me, and I can't quantify this, I haven't measured it yet, but it seems to me that that was much more explicit in the last couple of years, well, certainly in the presidential campaign, but then ever since then, as a way of making sure that people stay mobilized. And so it would be interesting to compare what Trump and those Republicans who adopted his kind of language, how well they fared or how useful it was for them compared to Democrats who may have used fear, but from the other end regarding all the bad things that would happen if the Republicans remain in office. I think it's becoming just a lot more clear. It's crystallizing for us just how important this has become. That might be just because the United States has become far more polarized over the years, over the decades, and maybe it just fits really well here. But I think we also have a sense that it's this fear of others has become more prevalent or more relevant to political campaigns around the world, as we've seen populist groups and individuals make these kinds of appeals, and in some cases they do really well, in some cases they win elections, but it seems to be working for people.
That's one of the more interesting takeaways, is whether or not appeals to race and whether or not appeals to fear and how effective that was, because certainly in a number of Senate races it seemed to play a pretty significant role, but it may not have played quite as well in some of the House races, but I think I think it's a reasonable expectation that that's a strategy that's likely to continue.
And the other thing I would add to that, you mentioned historical memory. That fear it's not just an emotional reaction, or it's not just trying to provoke an emotional reaction. The provocation of this emotional reaction is tied to a constructed historical memory of what the country used to, quote unquote, used to look like, by which they mean what we want it to look like. They're reading back what they want. They're reading back into history what they think the country looked like. And so in Europe and in Israel and the United States, the appeals that they use to strike this fear into the hearts of voters is based on some this constructed reality of what the country used to look like, what its identity was, what its values were. And all of those things were based on a very small or narrow community of citizens. The idea that everyone else who doesn't belong because they're different, that they might be taking over, they might be changing who we are and what we stand for and what our values are. That's where that fear is coming from.
Now, Pam, I know you are in New York and you do quite a bit of work with the UN. We're obviously going to have a new UN ambassador. What do you expect? This isn't necessarily the elections as much as it is the departure of Ambassador Haley, but what do you expect over the next 2 years of the U.S.'s relationship with the United Nations?
Probably not much different than it's been over the past 2 years. And when you look back, it really, with the exception of some of the inflammatory language, shall we say, that President Trump has used, generally speaking, the U.S. Voting record at the UN and the U.S. Actions at the UN have really not changed a lot over the past 2 years. The U.S. is still a staunch supporter of Israel at the UN, one of the few that will always vote in favor of Israel, and that rarely changes from administration to administration. While the Trump administration is planning to withdraw from the Paris Accord as soon as the U.S. is able to, the U.S. is still participating in negotiations under the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, just like it has participated in negotiations of numerous other treaties that the U.S. is not a party to. The U.S. always is at the table. With regard to the withdrawal from the Human Rights Council, which took place over the summer, that Nikki Haley announced because the Human Rights Council members are major human rights abusers, and the Human Rights Council has a standing item on Israel, but not a standing item on other human rights, on countries that the U.S. believes are human rights abusers. But the U.S. is still participating in, you know, they're not, they haven't left the room. They're still there. They're still paying attention to what's going on. But that was more of making a political point, which is not alone to Donald Trump. So while we hear a lot from him, so far it hasn't made that much of a difference. Now, a lot depends on who is going to be the next ambassador and whether that ambassador will, as Nikki Haley learned, feel the constraint of the position, that it doesn't give you a total open mic. She learned that pretty early. If you look at her speeches over the two-year period, they became a little more muted over time. You know, she sent a few little, you know, threw a few bones to Trump. But for the most part, after her warning that, you know, we'll be counting votes and things like that, she learned very quickly the value of diplomacy and how that works. So I'm not sure, you know, I've heard rumors, but nobody's been nominated yet. And I think a few trial balloons have been thrown out, but I don't know who's the next going to be the next ambassador. And a lot will depend on how quickly that person learns diplomacy or not.
And I think also another key variable here is that Nikki Haley, Ambassador Haley, had taken a pretty high profile for that position, I guess in large part because in some of the earlier days that she would strike a bit of a contrast with the president. And it seemed that she was able to walk a tightrope where she appeared sufficiently loyal that she certainly wasn't accused of not carrying out the president's foreign policy, you know, such as...
Well,
you know,
being in New York gives cabinet members a certain degree of distance. Mm-hmm. They're not in Washington. They're not in that echo chamber. They're not in that highly politicized world inside the Beltway. When you're in New York, you're not being monitored all the time. You have a certain degree of freedom. And so as long as she gave the occasional speech that made it to the White House and made news, she could do a lot without overtly contradicting the administration, but at the same time not overtly supporting some of the rhetoric out of the administration. It's a benefit of being in New York and not in Washington, and that distance is really important. And she also is the, you know, first member of the administration to actually leave on her own terms.
I was going to add to that also, she seems to have shared some of Trump's views on Israel and Iran also, so that probably helped her maintain that distance even more.
Now, we have one elephant in the room, and I want to make sure that we don't finish this without discussing this, and that is U.S.-Russian relations. Certainly, the midterms give Democrats an opportunity to investigate, but also speculation about the special counsel or about Robert Mueller. I'll give all three of you an opportunity to respond to this. We'll start with Amy. What do you think about the future of U.S.-Russian relations and what often gets referred to as l'affaire russe?
That's a great question. Honestly, I'll be surprised if this is not one of the areas where the House Foreign Relations or possibly Intelligence Committees kind of choose to flex their investigatory muscle. In terms of the Mueller investigation, I mean, this is absolutely a delicate question. And we've seen, obviously Jeff Sessions now out being fired and replaced with an acting attorney general who has been in the past somewhat critical of the Mueller investigation. So I don't know. I mean, I think if Trump were to attempt to interfere with the investigation or to fire the special counsel, you know, I mean, I think that would be a provocation to which the House Democrats would have to respond in some way, whether it's, you know, whether it's using that investigatory power or attempting to kind of give the special counsel some kind of a stage if, in fact, he ends up being terminated by Trump.
Brent, do you have any thoughts?
I think that you asked about U.S.-Russia relations, and I think that after the end of the Cold War, certainly in the early mid-90s or into the late 90s, there was a sense that things were getting so much better between the two countries, and that there was a lot of, there were still tensions and still areas where they disagreed or had opposite views or opposite positions, opposite interests on a series of issues. But there seemed to be some general sense that the world had turned over a new page regarding the two superpowers. And I think that attitude or that perception stuck with us, stuck with America, and to some extent stuck with people elsewhere in the world as well. But I'm not sure that it was that realistic to expect that that would continue, certainly after the end of the Yeltsin era, but even toward the end of his era when he was in power. And I think that, look, Russia just has a whole different set of interests, and their domestic politics plays out differently than it does in the United States, and it's not necessarily clear that things will get all that much better even when Putin eventually does leave the scene. There's no clear sense that whoever might replace him or whoever might come in the near future would make things very, very different. Even Barack Obama had trouble despite his interest in a reset. There was limits to what he could do, just based on what Russia was and what Russia wanted. And it doesn't seem like there's anything that would change at the domestic level in Russia to change that international calculus.
And Pam, do you have any thoughts?
I agree with what's been said already. I don't see, with the exception of oversight in the House, that there being a huge change because, as you noted in the beginning of this, that foreign policy is largely the purview of the executive branch. And also, we don't know what's really behind the Trump administration position on Russia. And we don't know what Mueller is coming out with. We can speculate, but we're not sure what, if anything, he's found at this point. We're not sure what business interests that the Trump organization may have with Russia and how that may be impacting our relations with Russia. So I don't think the elections are going, with the exception of oversight, going to change that relationship drastically at first. But once we find out, provided Mueller is protected and we do get results that give us a clearer picture, that then could have impact on things going forward.
The four of us all, as academics, are forced to speculate when we get asked about this, and we can try to speculate, but ultimately, I think the right answer is we need to wait and see. We need to wait and see what develops. I always like to say what makes politics so fascinating to me and what I try to pass on to my students is the way we view this as a great political drama. And we may be in a new chapter, but that chapter has just begun. So let me thank the three of you for joining us today in our conversations about the impact of the elections. Hopefully we can start seeing this start to crystallize a bit. And I'm sure, you know, in the same way the drama has just begun, the conversation has just taken a little bit of a different tone, a little bit of a different direction. And we're going to continue this conversation for the next 2 years. So thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to thank the panel, Pam Chasek, who's the chair of the Political Science Department at Manhattan College. She's the author of Transforming Multilateral Diplomacy, The Inside Story of the Sustainable Development Goals and the Global Environment in the 21st Century, Prospects for International Cooperation. Amy Eckert, who is professor of political science at the Metropolitan State University of Denver. She's the author of Outsourcing War, The Just War Tradition in the Age of Military Privatization, and a book chapter entitled Critical Approaches to the Ethics of War. And Brent Sasley, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Texas at Arlington. He's the co-author of Politics in Israel, Governing a Complex Society, and author of an article, Palestinian Roadblocks, Changing Attitudes Among Israeli Jews.
When we come back, what dictators, CEOs, and other political leaders have in common? We'll explore some of their strategies for getting and keeping power. Stay tuned.
Everybody knows that the plague is coming. Everybody knows that it's moving fast. Everybody knows that the naked man and woman are just a shining artifact of the past. Everybody knows the scene is dead, but there's gonna be a meter on your bed that will disclose what everybody knows.
Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. Is there a universal formula for getting and keeping power? Our next guest says there is, and it often involves what he calls bad behavior. Alistair Smith is professor of politics at NYU, New York University, and the co-author of The Dictator's Handbook, Why Bad Behavior is Almost Always Good Politics. Welcome, Alistair Smith.
I'm glad I could be with you.
You start by examining the city of Bell. Remind us of what happened in Bell and how this plays into your argument about bad behavior being good politics.
We regard all leaders, whether they're of corporations, sports federations, dictatorships, or democracy, as all having some basic desire, and that's to stay in power. And this would be exactly the same with leaders in Bell. The leadership there, the Rizzo, had set up this beautiful system where he got paid around, I think it was $700,000 salary. So he was massively more paid than virtually every other elected public official in the country. And he managed to do this because he engineered a system where he could be beholden to very few people to stay in power.
You're talking about the city manager.
Absolutely. And this is the goal that all leaders, this is one of the sort of five basic principles that leaders want to have. Of coming to power is they want to be beholden to very small numbers of people. They don't want to rely on many people to stay in power. And so he organized this very tiny sort of election to switch the charter of the city so it wasn't governed by the rest of the city, state of California. And this small rule change, which was a sort of an innocuous, boring, bureaucratic rule, so very few people turned up, meant that with a few hundred votes, he could actually assemble a city council that would vote through all the reforms he wanted. So his salary went up from, I think, around $150,000 to 10 years later being $700,000 plus. So he managed to do this because he could rely on very few people. And then the people on the town council that got elected with these very small numbers of voters, several hundred voters were all he needed really to keep most of these people in, they managed to vote themselves enormous salaries via special enterprise zones and special committees. That's how they got rich.
You talked about how the city then charged some 50% more for property taxes, and they just engineered this entire system of politics that resembles often what you say are dictatorship politics.
Absolutely. So one of the other fundamental rules you want to do is tax as heavily as you possibly can. Tax as heavily as the economy will bear, and your supporters will pay. Well, you know, Rizzo's now got the system where he's not actually beholden to very many people. Not many people pay attention to this small-scale town politics, changing the rules and such like. And most of the council members don't require that many votes, several hundred votes, to become a member of this committee. And so what they did was they taxed very heavily, much higher taxes than richer, wealthier neighbors that surrounded them. They brought all this money in, and they distributed it out to themselves and to favored people, but they didn't generate good public policy for the people. These are the rules. You want to reward those who are keeping you in power.
Why a small group to be beholden to? Why is that helping to keep certain people in power?
Leaders always, the best way to survive as a political leader is to reduce the number of people you need to stay in power. So this would be disenfranchising people in the electoral system is a perfect way to stay in power. That way you need the support of fewer people. So in the U.S., we see the Electoral College. That means the president only needs to win about 35 million votes to win the presidency. You typically get much more than that, but you don't need to win as many because you don't have to win half the support of half of the voters, which is what we typically think, but that's not what you need to do to actually win. So all leaders want to change the rules to get the group as small as possible. And the great thing is, if you don't have many people to reward, you can give each of them, and you, so just think of it in a very simple way. You have a pot of money. You don't have many people. They can each have a very large, each person's share of the pot of money is very large. That doesn't work once you get up into huge numbers because each person's share becomes very small. And so leaders, when they're beholden to a lot of people, they have to start producing good public policy, which is much harder to do. And it's easier for rivals to claim they can do a better job.
Now, one of the things that struck me in this book, it's actually in the very first chapter, you talk about politics not being complex, but then you say leaders are not monolithic, and it's silly to think that they are in control of their jurisdictions, whether they're countries or companies, and you take a look back at old France. What can we learn from old France, and how does this all come together?
Well, this is the great thing. So we tend to think of, you know, these regimes. We call them absolute monarchs when we think of sort of Louis XIV. He's an absolute monarch. You know, everything he said was law. Well, everything he said was law because the people that were enforcing the system agreed with him, everything that he said being law, because he was paying them a lot. So no leader stays in power by themselves. So whether we want to think of it as a corporation, or we want to think of it as a sports federation, or we want to think of it as a democracy, you have to have supporters to keep you in there to make the rules. So everybody relies upon keeping these supporters happy. So that's the simple objective of political leaders, is to keep these people happy to stay in power. The difference between all the different, how the different systems function, is the number of people that you have to keep happy.
And you talk about these three groups of peoples. You call them dimensions. Mm-hmm. You say they're consistent across governments, whether democracies or dictatorships. Explain these three groups of people, the nominal, real, selectorate, and the winning coalition, and how do we see them in both dictatorships and in democracies?
Yep. So when we tend to think about political organizations, we tend to think democracy and non-democracy, or a junta or a dictatorship. But what we don't realize is that there's enormous variation within those categories. So instead of thinking about that all democracies are the same and all autocracies are the same and all juntas are the same, we want to think about them on a continuum of scales. So the simplest scale is the winning coalition. How many supporters does a leader need? So we can think, here we've done some expert surveys asking sort of country experts, how many people does this leader really need? So it could be from a few hundred in some of the most autocratic systems like North Korea up to 35 million people in the United States to be president. So they can vary enormously. Then we want to think about, who really has some say. So in a democracy, that tends to be all adults. Or all adult citizens, I should say. So in the U.S., there's about 160 million registered voters. So that's the selectorate, and that's the people who get the choice. In other systems, it could be much lower. If we were in a monarchy, then we'd only be really worrying about aristocrats. If we were in a junta, we'd be worrying about the senior generals. So we want to worry about how many people we have to pick to be supporters, and how big a pool can we draw supporters from.
So what you're saying is the broader the selectorate, the more likely you'll have a system that is more democratic in nature and more perhaps egalitarian?
This is a classic mistake we want to think of. So you use the term selectorate there. So this is the pool of people who have some nominal say. So this would be an electorate. And in the U.S. system where we have fixed electoral rules, you're absolutely right that the more people we bring in into the electorate, the more the coalition of supporters of political leader needs, because we actually obey the electoral rules. But actually, this is one of the points we make in the book, is that rigged elections are sort of a terrible thing for the people. So in those kind of systems, what we do is we allow everyone to vote, but the votes really don't count. We know that that's not really the important point. It actually depends upon not who votes, but who counts. And it turns out the counters are the important people in an electoral system, in a corrupt electoral system. And one of the beautiful things about, and it's exactly the opposite to what you just said, is by making the electorate larger, we make the society more equal. We do exactly the opposite. What we do is we make the leader could still be beholden to a small number of people, but the corrupt electoral system allows the leader to find lots and lots of replacements. There's nothing special about people in positions of power in a democracy. They can be replaced by anybody. You can always rig another election to get somebody out of the parliament and bring back another crony. So it's not the electorate we should worry about. It's how many people matter.
You wrote about once these coalitions are put together by leaders in order to put them in power, that it often changes once they reach power. You use the example of Fidel Castro. What happened with Fidel Castro?
This is a classic case that all leaders face. Is when you come to power, you need the people who are in positions of authority now, for example, people in control of the army, people in charge of the police, to support you coming to power, or voters of the current regime in a democracy to turn against the incumbent to bring you to power. So you're very constrained in who you can choose when you try to come to power. When you put your coalition of supporters together, you've got to, in some sense, include some of the old guys because you needed them to come to you so that you could kick the incumbent out. But once you get there, you've got the problem that, well, these people have already demonstrated they're not very loyal. They just helped you bring down the previous guy. So you should sit there and think, I would like to get my cronies in, the people who are really loyal to me, people who only have a standing in society because of me, who won't be good rivals. And so then what leaders like to do is try and weed out the people they suspect of being disloyal and replace them with people that they think will be loyal over the long term. And so we see lots of culling of people when they come in. So we can think of some other classic examples. So as you pointed out, Castro, he wiped out most of the cronies that fought alongside him in, you know, the rebel movements. Very usual. People fighting, comrade in arms, they get into power. One guy comes in charge, all the other guys suddenly become traitors. Very familiar story. You could think of Adolf Hitler had, you know, the famous sort of Night of the Long Knives. The black shirts turned up and the SS turned up and took away all the brown shirts, his previous sort of paramilitary organization. Complete sort of culling overnight happened.
Do you see that much in democratic settings?
Well, we do. We don't see the violence. George W. Bush came to power, you know, with Christian conservatives. You don't see him, you know, dropping factions of the you don't see, you know, factions that he's no longer supporting their positions. We don't see them being knifed. But we do see that politicians come to power and they will move their support base. So they won't adopt, so they come to power promising to do X, Y, and Z, and maybe they do X and Y. They don't do Z, so some of the people are going to want to move from them, and at the same time, they'll be trying to attract supporters they think are going to be more likely to support them if they give them their policies. So we see this, politicians, as we all know, never completely honest about what they're going to do. Once they get in, they'll shift who they support.
So in essence, you say these rulers come into power with coalitions, then they shake them up, replace them, then allocate money to keep their new coalition happy, but not too happy, and then give enough to the rest to keep them from revolting.
That's right. You've been reading the book very carefully. You sort of summarized the rules, right? You want to get in a small number of people as possible from a big pool. You want to tax very heavily, which is sort of the one thing we haven't talked a huge amount about. Then you pay off the coalition. And then make sure you keep some money for yourself. Don't be too nice to the people. That's exactly what all good leaders who want to keep their job should do. And leaders get into trouble when they fail to follow these rules.
It's very Machiavellian, no?
Absolutely. And, you know, we've been accused of being very cynical. But cynical doesn't mean wrong. Cynical just means we believe it's both cynical and extremely accurate way to describe how politics works. And it is a cynical Machiavellian approach, but, you know, we spend a large portion of the end of the book developing ideas. We tell you how the system works. So this is how you fix it. You can't fix a system unless you understand how it works. You don't take your car to a mechanic if the mechanic has no idea how a car runs. They can't make your car work better if they don't understand how it works. So we spend a lot of time developing these rules and explaining how the system works, and then we tell you how you're going to fix the system.
You say leaders support those who support them or who will keep them in power, but couldn't it be the reverse? That their concern for a certain ideology dictates the bloc.
We don't deny that ideology and culture, that they exist, but we just think they're very convenient labels. So we can identify by these labels who's going to be rewarded and who's going to be punished. So if we want to think about, for example, in the U.S., we got the jobs bill. We can think of this as sort of a big ideological thing. Is it class warfare? Do we want to tax? Do we want tax and spend? Do we want to let free markets reign? We can think of a lot of ideological labels being used in this debate. But what it really comes down to is these labels are telling us who's going to win. Who's going to profit under the scheme if a leader comes in, and who's going to suffer? So let's take the extreme here. We've got, let's cut taxes. Well, who would benefit if we're going to cut taxes? Rich people are going to benefit if we cut taxes. Well, who tends to be rich? Republicans tend to be rich. They're going to like these policies. If we think about job creation, well, who's going to benefit from those? Well, unions, teachers, construction workers tend to be Democrats. So we may think of these as ideology, but we're really just identifying groups that are going to be rewarded under different sets of policies.
It could be that they actually believe in these policies, and so do those other people. Perhaps people on one side really want to stay in power in order to make sure the system is more egalitarian.
This is always, of course, we don't get the opportunity to see people act outside of this chicken or egg thing. So we have to look for a few examples of where people switch policies. So let me give you two. Let me give you an example, an American example, and then I'll move to a more extreme example. So think of a famous American politician, Strom Thurmond. So Strom Thurmond was a huge segregationist. He took positions that were highly racist. right up until the Civil Rights Acts came through, and suddenly he found out he had a constituency that was full of blacks. What did he do as soon as he had that? He completely switched the sets of policies he want. He went from this group should be disadvantaged to, oh, I have to rely upon a lot of this group now, I'm going to switch my policies. So here's a politician who knew what he needed to do and what he needed to do to stay in power shifted, so he changed policies. I can give you an even more extreme example, which is actually one of the few cases Bruce and I identified as a leader, an individual who's ruled two countries at the same time. Lots of people do it like you're the queen of one country and therefore you're, you know, a ruler of an empire, but as actually two independent countries. So King Leopold of Belgium also ruled the Congo, but he ruled that as he set this up as a private company that went over and captured the Congo for himself. So when he was back at home, he believed in liberal ideas, unions, promoting working standards and healthcare for an education for the people. And in the Congo, he was a brutal killer of anyone who resisted him in any way that stopped him making money on rubber. So we have to ask ourselves, leaders are doing what gets them in power and wealth. They're not adopting the same ideological conditions under two different circumstances.
Is this really applicable in the general sense, or are you taking a single individual and trying to say that all leaders are like him because he's the one example we have where you see a double ideology?
No, I think that's not that. We see changes at all. So one of the descriptions we spend a lot of time talking about was a classic reformer, which was Jerry Rawlings in Ghana. So we spend a lot of time talking about JJ, he was known as, Junior Jesus. He was a bit of a charismatic character in Ghana. Instituted a socialist revolution when he first came into power and wanted to pay the army and promote socialist ideas and damp out opposition to himself. This was right up until he ran out of money. And then we see him radically changing his policies, liberalizing, and he actually became the sort of poster boy for IMF reforms and then liberalizing democracy. But he didn't do this because he wanted to. He did this because he had to.
Is it that particular kinds of people pursue leadership?
We often get asked this. So people ask us, do you believe that all leaders are sort of nasty and brutish and self-interested? And the answer to that question is, well, first I scratched my head. I was like, all the words made sense, but put together, of course, they do. Yeah, what else could you possibly think? Is it possible that there are people who are less self-interested around the world? I suspect that that might be true. We could vary on that degree. But the point is, those kind of people are not going to run for political office. So we might ask ourselves, political leaders, seizing power in a democracy involves taking hideously violent acts and brutal suppression of opposition and often killing people. People who aren't interested in coming to power and paying those costs aren't the kind of people who become leadership roles. We shouldn't worry. So within the set of leaders, I think it's incredibly clear that they're all self-interested louts.
So it is the kind of person that finds himself or herself pursuing a position of leadership.
I tend to think, not everybody wants to be the leader of a country. I personally think it would be, being a leader would be a horrible job. But the set of people that do, there's a lot of people want to pursue power. There is no shortage of claimants to the throne, shall we say.
Is it possible for benevolent types, altruistic or symbiotic types, to be able to reach and keep leadership if, in fact, you are right about the process it takes to get into power and stay in power?
So you're maybe thinking, we have our Plato philosopher kings. Wouldn't this be perfect? Our benevolent dictator, he could just do the right thing.
I'm thinking not necessarily benevolent dictator. I'm thinking Jimmy Carter. Obviously, he didn't stay in office. So he pursued power, but he didn't keep power. Could we have people who are actually truly concerned about the plight of people?
I think you can, but they can't always act upon that all the time. So the first thing is, even if you want to really help the people, you can't help the people unless you stay in power. So the first and foremost job you have to do, even if you want to, in some sense, spend all the discretion you have on helping the people, is stay in power. And staying in power relies on keeping your cronies happy. So in a democracy, that actually generally means doing things that are good for the public good, because you have to keep so many people happy in the first place. You may as well work towards the public good in some sense. In an autocracy, it's very hard to spend money helping the people if that takes money out the pocket of your cronies. So we could think of a classic example would be Julius Caesar, right? There's a lot of confusion about him. Everybody thinks he's this guy who wants to be king in Rome. The reality is he went around reforming the roads, laying out the city, getting the water working, organizing the calendar, tons of things. But he made a big mistake, was he also started canceling debts of the common people to promote the economy. Well, of course, he relied upon members of the Senate and powerful rich people who were owned this debt. They were very unhappy about this, and so they stabbed him down. So you can only be good if it comes out of your pocket, not out of your crony's pocket.
You know, you reminded me of this section of your book about infrastructure and education, and I was struck by the leader, the African leader, who said to the Rwandan president, don't build roads because then those are more roads they can come and get you with. And the only roads to develop are the ones that help you get out when you need to.
Absolutely. And he was quite ruthless in his pursuit of power and maintenance of power. He didn't give a damn about the people of Zaire. They lived miserable, miserable lives. Let me give you another example rather than just the roads, which he did. He inherited like 70,000 miles of roads. And when he left, you know, several decades later, it was only like 6,000 miles of roads left. He got rid of them and just let them decompose. But he actually decided he was going to run his copper mines that were down in the south of the country with hydroelectric power stations from the river right near where he controlled in the north. So he ran a power line, basically close to 1,000 miles across the country. And he actually went out of his way to bypass all the cities and towns on the way so that no one would have electrification. But he maintained the key thing was that since he then controlled the power supply, he could turn off the copper production. If anyone else tried to steal it and seize control and get the wealth from the copper mines, he could control that copper mine. So he was focusing on bringing the wealth to him.
And similar with education.
Absolutely. Want to educate people. If you're an autocrat, you want to educate people to the extent that they can do the jobs you need them to do. And so educating them more than that, giving people an advanced education, people learn how to organize against you. And we saw that leaders in Egypt, for example, got in trouble because they had a large number of educated and underemployed people who could organize protests against them. If you keep the people poor and ignorant and separated, very, very hard for them to organize against you.
Let's talk for a moment about the corporation, because you say these apply also to corporations.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And specifically with the same kinds of rules, but then also how corruption really helps. How does it help these leaders?
Well, so the reality is we think of the classic economic model is the company is out there maximizing profit. They're not maximizing profit. They're not helping companies. Leaders want to stay at the top of their corporations, and so they have to keep the support of people. So who are the supporters in a publicly traded company? We'd like to think it's the shareholders, but you and I are all own some kind of share, and occasionally we get those proxy forms through the mailbox, right? And what's the first thing we do with that? We look and, I don't understand what this is, and we throw it away. So most of the time, we have a nominal say. We have a vote, but our votes don't matter. Control of publicly traded corporation comes down to the board, a few senior management, and a few big institutional investors. So that's typically tens of people. It's rarely more than tens of people. And yet these can be huge multi-billion dollar organizations.
When we look at a system where there is considerable corruption, you say that if we do things like increase sentencing, look at legislative fixes, they're counterproductive in part because they give leverage to the powerful. Why do you say that?
Well, you know, let's stay on the sort of business environment now. We just sort of said, you know, corporations are run with a relatively small group of supporters, and we want to know why people are on occupying Wall Street screaming about why Wall Street is so tone deaf to the plight of the people. It's because the leader's beholden to this small number of people, and how should they be rewarding them with big bloated consultancies and big private fees for running corporations, and executive salaries should be huge. So we get this kind of corruption. And so what we're seeing is we expect to see these big salaries. So, you know, the call at the moment for reform is let's outlaw these large salaries and everything. And this is a terrible thing to do because this is the basis of corruption. Would we sooner see things paid illegally rather than legally? If the basis of political power is rewarding a small number of people, it's always going to be involving large amounts of transfers of cash. So, you know, we see this in the Olympic Committee. We see huge bribes being paid for votes to locate the Olympics in a particular city. So outlawing things, ignoring the underlying political incentive, is always the wrong way to go. And I think you're pointing to the section of the book where we say, if you make a law against sort of taking bribes and bad behavior, all you really do is empower the person who gave out the bribe, but they now have evidence to keep people in line even more.
And so you say the incentive system itself should perhaps be changed.
Absolutely. There's no point changing a rule. So, you know, if you take a salary above $10 million, you've broken the law. Because then people are going to start trying to reward supporters through the back door, so long as leaders are beholden to a small number of people. So what you want to do is you've got to change the actual governance structure. So if we go to the sort of the Olympic Bribe Committee, which is something many people are familiar with, the Salt Lake City bribery, every year there's huge amounts of bribery, and I'm a huge soccer fan. FIFA's full of bribery about where they're going to locate the World Cup of soccer. Every year it's... But the reason is there's lots of bribery because so few people are involved in making that decision. All we have to do is to make those decisions get made better and outlaw corruption is simply have the decision depend upon more people.
How would that apply in governance?
In a corporation, we want...
Political governance.
Political governance, well, we want to make the President of the United States more accountable to the people. We should get rid of the Electoral College. The president would overnight have to appeal to twice the number of people he currently has to appeal to. So at the moment, you need to win half the seats in, you know, sort of half the states. Win even less because some states are overrepresented in the Electoral College. So half the seats, so that's in half the you need half the votes in half the states, so that's 25% of the vote. If you had got rid of the Electoral College, all of a sudden you need 50% of the vote. So instantly you make the president work much harder. He's got to keep twice as many people happy as he was before. In Congress, we get the same thing, gerrymandering. So many districts are so highly gerrymandered where the politicians pick their voters rather than the voters pick their leader that you can control Congress. Very few of the seats are competitive.
Alistair Smith, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. The name of the book is The Dictator's Handbook, Why Bad Behavior is Almost Always Good Politics. Thank you so much.
That'd be my pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks to all who made this program possible, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Sad Dongre, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed a part of the show, you can find our archives at scholarscircle.org. Please like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Armudian. See you next week.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get richer.